In the cover story for our June issue, the classicist Ralph McLaughlin writes about Imperial Rome's desire for an African empire. His article describes a fierce struggle for trade, land, and the search for the source of the Nile. History Today editor Paul Lay spoke to Raoul recently by phone to discuss the subject in greater detail.
Raoul, the Romans were just one of many powerful regimes in the classical era, and the products of this wide world came into the lives of Romans in the cities where spices, for example, were traded and other products. And one of those places in the wider world was the kingdom of Meroe. Can you tell us where that kingdom is and what it is?
Right. Meroe has a very, very ancient past. I mean, we have records from the time of the earliest pharaohs describing this kingdom to the south of Egypt. It occupies a very large stretch of territory, probably as long as the Nile, controlled by Egypt. And what we find is that Egypt, during the Old Kingdom period, begins trading, receiving goods from this territory, which is a conduit, a way through the Sahara to get to the goods, the resources of sub-Saharan Africa. So ivory and African slaves and spices, what the Americans call spices, but incenses, frankincense and myrrh, these fragrant resins produced in Somalia, which are then brought across to the Nile and trafficked down into Egyptian territory. And they become very important for religious rites in Egypt, and then by the Greeks, and then by the Romans. There's spices and incenses used in mummification processes. So these are very significant for Egyptian society.
And the people who inhabit this land between North Africa and sub-Saharan Africa in the earliest times are called the Kush.
Yes.
And can you tell us something about them? Because they're a warrior race, essentially. At least they became that, didn't they?
Yes. What you find is that the Egyptians, they extend their territory. They move south into the northern Sudan, into these kind of sub-Saharan territories. And they engage with these Nubian people, who they call the Kush. They take their territory, conquer the area in the second millennium BC. So this is ancient times for even the Romans. And, they, after conquering this territory, they introduced their own religions, their own institutions, and what you find is that the Kush begin to adopt Egyptian styles of thinking and influence the Egyptians as well. And what you have is, in the 8th century BC, there's a decline in Egyptian power. And the people of the Kush, these so-called African pharaohs, they move north, they conquer Egypt, and they, in their turn, rule Egypt as this 25th dynasty, these African pharaohs. And we have inscriptions from this time. We have these very striking images of these Nubians, these Kush people, presented as pharaohs. And they kind of implant more of their culture on Egypt. And that lasts for about a century until you have invasions from the Near East and the Egyptians re-establishing their authority.
And so those invasions from the Near East would include the Persian Empire?
Yes, yes. Of course, the Persians expand to take most of these Near Eastern civilizations, including Egypt. And there is a confrontation then between the Persians and the Kush. What you have is Cambyses, the second, the Persian king, decides to investigate the possibilities of extending his empire into African territory, and he sends a very large army south along the Nile, and I mean into these kind of narrow gorges and canyons, and there's deserts and rocky mountains on either side. So this is somewhere quite extreme, and it really tests the limits of what the Persians can do. And they are hasty in their attack. They don't bring enough supplies. They march into the desert. They follow the route of the Nile, and they run out of supplies. There's rumors of cannibalism in the army, and the king has to return to Egypt.
And which king is this?
Cambyses. He has to return to Egypt and accept that Nubia and the Kush may be beyond the limits of his conquest.
And so that's the background to the story. But the meat of it is very much the confrontation between Meroe and the Roman Empire. And the crucial period here seems to be that of the final civil war of the Roman Republic, when we have Mark Antony and Cleopatra VII, the famous but historical Cleopatra, and Octavian, the future Augustus, on the other side.
Yes, that's right. We have a situation where Augustus wins the civil war. He captures Egypt. He dissolves the Ptolemaic dynasty. And he installs a governor, a man called Cornelius Gallus, a military officer in charge of Egypt. And as well as being a military man, Gallus has a certain reputation for being a poet.
And he's highly regarded by figures as famous as Virgil and Ovid, isn't he?
Yes, that's right. Until recently, we didn't have any extracts from his work. So there was a lot of grand statements made about his significance and his skill of writing poetic verse. So he is placed in charge, and he's given this what was a former kingdom, an enormous territory and very wealthy. And early on in his command, he has to lead the army south and sort of secure the frontiers of Egypt and suppress a revolt. But he also comes into contact with ambassadors from Kush.
And so that's the kingdom of Meroe. And what is their relationship like between them, Cornelius Gallus and his forces, and those of Meroe?
Well, Meroe has maintained diplomatic contacts with the Ptolemies, these Greek rulers, and even Cleopatra herself. So they are, I suppose, vaguely aware of the situation in the Mediterranean. And certainly Egypt and Greek Egypt. But what you find with Gallus is that he may overstate his own influence and political authority. He sets up these grand monumental inscriptions that proclaim that he has indoctrinated Meroe. He has brought Meroe within the Roman sphere. He has almost created a situation where Meroe would be a vassal state of the Roman Empire. So that's what he says in the Latin version of his inscription. But in the Greek inscription, it's far more moderate language. It's far more diplomatic. And really what might have occurred is there was an acceptance of an alliance or perhaps non-aggression between the two states.
And we finally have this project that seems both modern and so ancient too, which is the attempt to find the source of the Nile, or to get some idea of the scale of the Nile there, the White Nile. And this project, a Roman project, ends in disaster.
Yes, I mean, it had fascinated the ancient world where exactly the sources of the Nile were. These seasonal surges of water that came from somewhere deep in Africa. And when you consider that most of the rest of North Africa is desert, it's rocks and sand, sandy plains and gravel valleys and sand dunes. But in the case of the Nile, there is this watercourse. And during the mid-first century AD, Nero is looking for new sources of wealth.
This is the Emperor Nero.
No? Yes, yes. There's this the great fire in Rome. There's other disasters. The Emperor is a spendthrift with his money. He is patronizing a lot of people, spending a lot of wealth on grand projects, his golden palace in Rome. So there is a search for wealth, a search for new revenue sources. And the emperor seeks to expand the empire, looking at the possibilities of that. And of course, Moreau is a target. It controls Sudan, it controls access to Africa. And the Romans aren't sure what's done there. They know that, well, ivory is extremely valuable in Roman society. Ebony is extremely valuable. So he organizes a party. He manages a group of centurions and people chosen from the Praetorian Guard, bodyguard in Rome. And they are sent out on a mission. They are sent south to make contact with the King of Moreau and ask for guides and assistance and letters of introduction to other African kingdoms as they head south, try to find the source of the Nile.
And they encounter a huge geographical and environmental barrier, which is the Sud.
Exactly. This mass of rotting, fetid vegetation. The size of this area in during the wet season, it's probably the size of England.
And where are we talking about this in terms of modern geographical terms? Where is it now?
It would be the White Nile.
In southern Sudan?
Yes. En route to, I suppose, Lake Victoria. And well, people still argue about the sources of the Nile. But it wasn't until the age of the explorers, the colonial David Livingstone, people like that, 19th century explorers, that they were actually able to get round the Sud, get across it, and manage to find Lake Victoria and these other possible sources, feeder river.
And so they return to Rome, having failed to find the source, but having gone deeper south into Africa than Europeans were to do for almost two millennia.
Yes, they couldn't find a way across the Sud. It was disease, it was the heat, it was the threat of starvation, just the enormity of this feature. And they reported to Nero that, Nero and Seneca, the statesman philosopher, they said that they had seen water issuing from the Sud, and they assumed that there was some, I suppose, underground feeder lake, a kind of fountain where the Nile bubbled up into this vast expanse. And for a long time, that was the best solution anyone could offer.
Mm. Well, it's a fascinating tale, Raoul, and it's the cover story on the new edition of History Today, the June edition of History Today. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.